Time for the next session, believe it or not. 15 minutes can go by very quickly. As you may know, the ELI has been engaged on its own Seeking Evidence of Impact program for about 2 years now. We embarked on this because we noted the need for evidence-based practice in teaching and learning. And we've been working with our colleagues for a while now, as I said, 2 or 3 years, in order to share methodologies and results. So I'm very delighted to be able to introduce two of our leading proponents in evidence-based practice here on a single program in the same room. And what I appreciate about this pair is that they have arrived at this emphasis on evidence-based practice by complementary paths. Ray Fleming is a professor of psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. With his colleague, Professor Diane Reddy, he has developed the U-PACE method of instruction and is currently a co-PI on an NGLC grant aimed at disseminating the U-PACE method on a variety of campuses. J.D. Walker is a research fellow at the University of Minnesota. His background is in philosophy, in which he earned a PhD from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, in 1996, and which he taught as a faculty member at the University of Minnesota, Duluth, the University of Pennsylvania, and Franklin and Marshall College. Both Ray and Walker have authored Seeking Evidence of Impact case studies, which you can find on our ELI website. And now, without further ado, I should say, Ray and Walker.
Hi, folks. I am Walker, and thank you very much, Malcolm, for that introduction. So what we want to do with you today is to use the case studies that Ray and I have produced as part of the Seeking Evidence of Impact program to illustrate more general points about conducting research and evaluation on technology-enhanced learning. So really our focus today is not going to be on the specific findings that we discovered in the course of our research. That's not the focus. Instead, we're going to try to use the case studies as a springboard to make more general points. Really, this talk is going to be about it's about impact evaluation in two senses. Conducting research and evaluation on the impact of technology in education. And then on the other hand, conducting research which has an impact on your institution's practices, your institution's culture, your institution's decisions. So that's the general idea of what we're going to do today. So my case study describes one aspect of a larger research project that we've conducted at the University of Minnesota for a number of years now. And that project has to do with examining the educational impact of new technology-enhanced learning spaces on our campus. And you can see here a picture of the brand spanking new building in which we have about 15 of these spaces, and then a picture of the interior of one of the spaces, which we call active learning classrooms itself. They differ in obvious ways from your traditional lecture hall. They have tables which seat 9 students at each table. There are microphones at the tables. There are laptop hookups at those tables. There is an instructor podium from which the instructor can project stuff to any of the display screens around the room. But importantly, the rooms do not have a central focus in the way that a traditional lecture hall does, right? There's no one point in the room to which your eye is drawn, not quite like this, but in a traditional lecture hall. So the instructor podium is just kind of in the middle. The perimeter of the room has multiple display screens on which student work from the tables can be displayed or the instructor's materials themselves. There are whiteboards, marker boards for student group use. Right? So the rooms are really set up to encourage a kind of active learning pedagogy. We began looking into the educational impact of these rooms in fall of 2007. And at this time, we were very much in exploratory mode. This was the pilot phase of our research. We didn't really know what the educational impact of these rooms was going to be, if any. Maybe it would make no difference at all to teaching and learning. So our methods were largely qualitative at this point. We used instructor interviews, focus groups, and surveys to investigate student and faculty responses to the rooms, their reactions to them, problems that they encountered using these rooms to teach and to learn in. The results at this point were positive enough that we felt we could go on to the next phase, and I've just given you a little outline of some of the results there. What we wanted to do after this exploratory phase was do something more systematic, to conduct research that would really enable us to isolate the impact of these new learning spaces on how teachers teach and how learners learn. So we constructed a number of comparison design studies in which we compared student responses, instructor behaviors, and student learning outcomes between different types of learning environments, between traditional classrooms and active learning classrooms, and also between different ways of using the active learning classrooms, between lecturing or doing presentation mode instruction in those rooms and using a more student-centered pedagogy in those rooms. So as you can see here, this is sort of a money shot slide of the improvement in student learning outcomes that we found in the active learning classrooms across several different classes. From here, we went on to, so we've achieved these findings, which we think are pretty powerful. We found something like a 4 to 5% increase in student learning compared to traditional classrooms in the new environments. So what we wanted to do after that, and what we're in the phase we're in right now, is trying to extend these results and to replicate them in different environments. So in spring 2012, we conducted measurements in about 24 classes that were being held in the active learning classrooms. And we expanded the range of material, that is to say subject matters, that were being taught in these classes. So classes from biochemistry to Spanish to organizational leadership, across a wide variety of curricula at the University of Minnesota. So we're really trying to improve the external validity of what we've done and see if it applies in other contexts. We're also trying to determine whether or not the findings of our earlier stage of research are applicable in a hybrid format. So we're working with a chemistry professor who teaches a very large introductory chemistry class, about 360 kids per semester, in one of those enormous, she taught it last year, in one of those enormous lecture halls that is kind of dark and built in the 50s and guaranteed to put about 40% of your students to sleep. And they did go to sleep. And what she's done now is to cut the course into thirds, and she meets with each third of the course one day a week, so only an hour of face-to-face time per week in one of the larger active learning classrooms. Right. So the face time has been reduced by two-thirds, and she's using student-centered learning techniques in these rooms, and we're going to find out whether or not the effects of the active learning classrooms are powerful enough to translate into good learning outcomes in that environment. So that's where we're at right now, and that's kind of the nickel tour of about 6 years of research that we've conducted on these classrooms. The general points that I'm hoping that you'll take away and that I want to make about this larger project from which our case study is derived are three things, really. To make a project like this successful and to make research on educational technology successful, I think you should specialize. In other words, you shouldn't try to research everything, but instead conduct a series of studies over time and broadly within the same general area of research, around the same technological intervention, around the same technology. I think if you do this, it has two good effects. It makes your research better, because when you conduct research in the same general area over time, if you have an ongoing research project, your methods get better, your data analytic procedures get better, you refine instruments, you're able to test them with large samples and with different samples over time. So the research itself gets better. And secondly, your impact on your institutional practice improves as well. So the group that I work with consists of 3.25 people devoted to conducting research in this area. And I think we've finally developed a reputation as people who understand something about learning spaces. And we've developed that reputation both internally at the University of Minnesota and outside of it. And so we're starting to have an impact on institutional decisions for that reason, which we wouldn't have if we had just conducted one study, however high quality that study was. The second thing that I think you should do to make your projects successful is to compare stuff within the research process. And I mean to contrast that with just describing things. And I'll tell you why this is so. I think research in this area has to be practical. And I mean by that it has to be structured in such a way as to reach conclusions that are normative, and that provide guidance for administrators, for policymakers, for faculty members as they approach decisions about educational technology. So you want to reach a conclusion in the end that's something like, you should try this if you want to improve student learning outcomes or student engagement or student enrichment. So the reason I've got these numbers on the screen right there, let me give you an example. So suppose I told you that in one large study of iPad use in the classroom, We found that students gave the iPad a mean score of 2.59 on a 4-point scale in terms of its enrichment of their learning experience. Right? 2.59. Is that good? Is it bad? You know, the midpoint's about 2.5 on this scale, right? So it's slightly above the midpoint, but it's hard to tell what you should do with that one number. You need context, right? You need benchmarking of some sort to know whether or not, to know what action to take on the basis of that number. If I go on to tell you that students whose professors used the iPad in only one of their classes rated the iPad on this same enrichment scale, a 2.2 out of 4, and students whose professors used the iPad in 4 or more of their courses rated it 3.3 on the 4-point scale, you're starting to learn something interesting. And if I tell you furthermore that not only the enrichment scale but also several important dependent variables showed this same pattern, students rating the iPad higher on that variable the more they used it, the more classes they used it in, now you're discovering something interesting. Now you have a basis on which to say, if you want to improve enrichment in the classroom using the iPad, use it in a lot of classes. And students are going to find their learning experience enriched. So, the third thing that I think you should do is to research mechanisms. So I think there's a tendency to stop once you find an association between two things that are important in your research, but I think that's not enough. Even if you find a good association of the sort that you were looking for, you've confirmed a hypothesis, try to find out why that's so. What is the mechanism underlying the association that you found? In virtue of what does it hold? In our active learning classroom research, we're looking into several different types of mechanisms. I think looking into mechanisms has really two good effects. On the one hand, it shows that your research is not spurious, that your findings are not spurious. They weren't just a matter of happenstance, because you know why they happened in the way that they did. And researching mechanisms allows others to take your work away, right? So they can understand the applicability of your findings in their context if they understand the mechanism by which it's occurred. When it comes to the active learning classroom research, we found a number of moderator variables. We've discovered that teaching in active learning classrooms changes instructor behavior independent of learning activity. So instructors do different stuff in different rooms. And we're studying that using GIS technology to map out instructors' movements through the physical space. This is interesting. We think that the new classrooms change relationships. The relationships among students themselves and between students and instructors by breaking down hierarchies within the classroom. We think they create educational alliances between instructors and students. And finally, we think room size is an important moderator of these effects. So there's a question, how big can you make one of these classrooms? Right? Because you know, the chemistry folks want to have a classroom of 350 kids. Can you make it that big and still get good effects? We're not sure that you can, so we're looking into this as well. So that's it for my part. I thought I would pause here and just see if you have any questions about my case study before we get on to Ray's material. Yeah. Okay. Could you go to the microphone, please, if you don't mind, so our online audience can hear?
Well, it's a very simple question. So, what is the size of these renovated classrooms?
They range in size on our campus from 36 to 120-ish. So 120 is the top end.
And has there been additional faculty development for faculty using those rooms, or do they just come in and use them?
We're a big campus. It's very distributed, and a lot of folks just get assigned to these rooms and just end up there. But we are developing systematic faculty development efforts to prepare faculty for these rooms because we think that's necessary.
I was wondering how you measured student learning.
We've usually measured it using course grades sometimes, and in other cases we've used validated standardized instruments. So in the chemistry course that we're looking at, the one that I mentioned, we're using an ACS measure of introductory chemistry learning. Mm-hmm.
So.
you know, grades don't always measure learning, and that's why I was wondering what else you were looking at, or if you were.
We're trying to include other measures in addition to grades. Grades are easy, grades are there, and so forth. We often break down learning outcomes into individual assignments so that we can see the effects of the new learning environments on, like where are they occurring, for just some assignments and not for others or across the board.
I'm curious, you mentioned a chemistry class that was going to basically split into thirds and become hybrid. Does, and my impression was that that's in progress, so I can't ask you any conclusions about that, but how is that being treated in terms of, at least in terms of the faculty? Is that, I'd be really curious what that faculty member thinks in terms of, does that feel about like the same level of course load for that person? Does it feel like it's half again as much work? Does it feel like it's, I'm curious how that's going to be treated. I mean, you could think of it as three sections of hybrid courses, or you could treat it as one section of hybrid course.
Right. It has been something of a journey for this particular faculty member. So it's been a process for her, and a lot of the effort was front-loaded because she had to create videos up front addressing. So the students are basically doing a lot of the didactic information absorption part on their own online, and they're engaged in student-centered learning activities when they're in the ALCs once a week. So I think it feels like the effort was front-loaded, and now it's about like teaching a regular course, although she's learned a lot, and she's changing her procedures to do it again this spring, which she's doing right now. So, maybe one more question, then we should get on to raise material. And we'll have more time at the end for more stuff. So, yes, ma'am. It is a number of things. So the question was really what makes the active learning classrooms different from traditional classrooms, and a couple of things. On the one hand, technology, right? So the display technology is different from a traditional classroom. In a traditional classroom, you've got like one big screen, and the instructor stuff goes up there, and everybody looks at it, right? So there are individual display screens which are designed to project what students are doing at the individual tables at which they're sitting. And that's the other thing, which is the physical layout of the room is not chairs and rows like this, but it's round tables, students facing one another, which is designed to enhance and encourage various kinds of collaborative learning activities for students. Okay, and I should hand it over to Ray now. Thank you.
Thanks, Walker. So, Walker took us through the ALC research, talking about what works from the perspective of the research, and mentioned to us that one of the things we need to do is look at the mechanisms by which these kinds of interventions work. So what I'm going to do, or what I hope to do in this talk, is to review impact evaluation with a mindset focused more on mechanisms of what works, so on mediators of the process. Our research on UPACE instructional method is a little farther along, and we're able to use it then as a guide for the discussion. So what you see here is intervention leading to outcome, sort of a very bland, straightforward sort of thing. In any of what I'll be talking about, the really critical element will be measurement. Measurement of elements of the intervention, measurement of the outcomes, measurement of the mediators or process of the effects, and measurement of the larger effects within the environment. So with the UPACE, we have two aspects to the instructional method. It's mastery-based, so it's self-paced and it's online, and students must perform to the mastery criterion, 90% or above, before new material is released to them. The information in the course is released in chunks of material that are approximately half a chapter. So they'll have, instead of three or four exams across the semester, they'll have 24 quizzes. Each quiz they need to meet the 90% or better criterion before we give them new information. The LMS, of course, is set up to release that information. The second part of the instructional method is what we call amplified assistance. And if you were here for Vincent Tinto's talk, were some of you here for that? He talked about intervening and how it's done too late. So you have standard university protocol is to get students to the attention of professors within the first 6 or 8 weeks, and it's much too late. And I believe Dr. Tinto was saying that 8 days is certainly the point at which it becomes stale. In the U-PACE method, what we do is use information about the student's behavior that's recorded in the LMS to monitor what they're doing and what they're not doing, so that we can get intervention to them at a moment's notice. And in this case, what the instructor is set up to do is to be the person who does the troubleshooting with the student. So if you have a student who hasn't looked at the material in a few days, and you can see that on the LMS, then that information is used to reach out to the student without the student having to contact the instructor. Very important point. Right. So we have a basic definition of what the U-PACE instructional method is about, right? It's mastery-based, and we reach out to the students using information from the LMS on their behavior before they need to reach out to us. And that's done consistently throughout the semester. On the outcome side, right, we've measured academic success, right? This is in terms of grades, and I'll show you information on how well they perform with regard to B's and A's in the course, all objectively measured, and deeper learning. Right? We'll see that on learning tests. So the measurements that I talked to you about, all final grades, as I mentioned, were objectively determined, and the assessments of student learning were developed with the revised Bloom's taxonomy in mind, so that we're working toward more complex, all right, information rather than simple fact remembering and spitting out. We're working our way up toward that. Students who earn final grades in this system of A or B understand the concepts at a deep level, and I hope to show you that in a moment. So here we have data from the U-PACE trial. You have four bars. The far two right bars show you the U-PACE performance, and the two bars on the left show you the conventional classroom performance. What you can see pretty easily is that on the right, the two bars are significantly higher. There's more A's and B's than on the left, so U-PACE has produced more A's and B's than conventional instruction. And if you look to the center, where we have the two bars that are juxtaposed, you can see that we've split both U-PACE and conventional instruction into two subgroups, disadvantaged and what we call not disadvantaged. For the purposes of this disadvantage are students who are eligible for federal Pell Grants and or are members of targeted racial or ethnic groups that are targeted because of the possibility of not completing the degree. So if we look in the center two bars, you can see that the right of the center two, we have U-PACE disadvantaged students performing better than conventionally taught, not disadvantaged students. Right? What we also see at the top of the graph is that the gaps in achievement comparing both conventionally and U-PACE taught students who are disadvantaged and not have been lowered with the U-PACE instructional method. The gaps for the conventional classes are 14 percentage points, and for the U-PACE, about 8.5. I also told you that we would look at deeper learning. So we took and randomly sampled from among both the U-PACE and face-to-face classes students, and we brought them into a room where they took a proctored cumulative exam. It did not count for their grades in the course, but we had them sign the exams, told them we wanted them to work on the exams to the best of their ability, and they had to work at least for 30 minutes on the exam before they could be dismissed. What you can see on the left of the two bar graphs is that at the end of the course, U-PACE students in the blue outperformed the face-to-face students by about 21 percentage points on the exam. We took these same students 6 months later, gave them another exam, cumulative exam, and UPACE students once again outperformed their counterparts in the face-to-face class. So what I had alluded to earlier is that both Walker and I were talking about what it is that works with technology-enabled intervention, but also that we need to talk about why those interventions work. So as I had mentioned, I thought that you want to look a little bit at the mediating processes. Right? So now we have intervention leading to outcome, but we have a mediator box in the center. The putative mediators for the UPACE instruction effects are student engagement, this was mentioned in Vincent Tinto's talk, and sense of control. This is one of the most ubiquitous findings in psychology, that if we have a sense of control, we tend to continue our behavior. And when we lose that sense of control, students say, well, I get all stressed out, but also we'll quit on what it is that we're doing. So part of what we want faculty in the UPACE instruction to do is to maintain the engagement with the students, so feedback to them in such a way that it maintains their engagement and make sure they have this sense of control. So we measured both of those. We look at the intervention impact for student engagement, and you can see the bar on the right, the green bar, is the UPACE students. They report working on the course about 7.3 hours per week, significantly greater than the red bar on the left for the face-to-face students. Right, so the UPACE instructional method is associated with greater engagement, more working on the course for those students. In terms of the perceived control measure, we have two bars once again. The green bar on the right and the red bar on the left are different scores from the beginning of the semester to the end. To look at a mediator of an effect, you need to watch the change in that mediator across the time that the effect is meant to unfold. While both of these groups, the UPACE and face-to-face, started at the same point in terms of their perceptions of control, we can see that although the UPACE students significantly incremented upward in their sense of control, as also mentioned in that talk, there's a decrement in the perceived control in the red bar for the students in the face-to-face course. So what do we have? We have a model here where we can start to ask more statistically oriented questions, not only about what am I doing, the intervention, and is it working, what are these outcomes, right? But the process through which these outcomes might work. Nothing about the model itself proves the process, right? But the measurement and the way it's carried out is what leads one to have confidence that the variables in question, in this case engagement, student engagement in the course, and sense of control, are those putative mediators that lead to your effect. So we now have more than just saying, I have an intervention, we'll call it the UPACE instructional method, and it's really, really good and has these outcomes, but we have to investigate why we get the outcomes. And when we do that, we start to peel apart the onion to understand where our next movement or our next intervention should come. Finally, to sort of finish out the full cycle, right? So I call this an inquiry cycle. We went from intervention to mediators to outcome and then change. And we can see that change will be seen on the level of students, faculty, and the university itself. At UWM, the outcomes for the UPACE instructional techniques have led to the stimulation of more UPACE courses. In fact, we now have UPACE courses or are about to have UPACE courses in six different disciplines on campus. And what we hear from the provost office at the university is that the emphasis on quality and on measurement has led to faculty on campus to use some of what we're doing in our investigations of this online method to improve their face-to-face methods themselves. So we've influenced self-paced, competency-based nature of UWM's new Flex Degree program This was highlighted by the chancellor of the university, who pointed to UPACE as one of the evidence-based practices on campus that they're going to use to build aspects of the measurement process for the Flex degree program. And finally, the outcomes have shaped student advising toward more high-quality and proactive communication, not only within departments and faculty, but also in terms of the advising system on campus. So this inquiry cycle, as I started out, looks as though it would naturally start from intervention and lead through mediators to outcome and then possibly produce change. But the reality is with the UPACE, the change part or the change elements were really the initiators of the process itself. So the Letters and Science College on campus and the Department of Psychology faculty members got together with the unitary goal to improve student learning, student outcomes. There was no reasoning that we should have a face-to-face version or an online version of what we were doing. We're just getting together to see what we should do. And over a period of 5 years, we began, Diane Reddy is in the back here, and I began moving the inquiry forward about UPACE. So I'll open at this time for any questions you might have.
Hi, I was wondering, you mentioned engagement and control as two mediating factors in the success of UPACE. How did you know at the beginning of your study to look for those factors? Did you look at those among others and then see that that had that impact on UPACE, or how did you do that?
Right, at some level, right, we have an understanding that students who engage more in the course should logically do better. I can't really take credit for that. That's really Dr. Reddy's sort of thinking process. So that came about just as a sort of a question and answer, right, of what should we measure to make sure we can develop and show data on the process itself. There's a second part then? The sense of control is sort of, as I said, a ubiquitous finding in psychology that much of what governs our behavior when we're in situations, we think of stressful situations, or when we're in circumstances where you might expect someone to either maintain or not maintain a behavior. Sense of control is a long history of research for that. So that's where we came. Yes.
Hi. I'm wondering if I could pose two questions, and then you could choose the one to respond to.
Okay, I'll okay. choose the easy one.
Okay, sure. So my first question, I guess, is you mentioned that this protocol allows instructors or the administration to reach out to students rather than have students reach out. And I'm just wondering, playing devil's advocate a bit, does that perhaps teach a kind of learned helplessness? Like, in other words, should we be fostering that kind of proactive self-advocacy that would prompt them to reach out? So that's the first question. Okay. The second one is, I noticed that the gap between the UPACE students and the regular students diminished after 6 months, which surprised me. I thought it would go the other way. I'm wondering if you would, if you're planning on doing it again after a year or 2 years, because to see if that shrinking okay. continues.
Let me take them in opposite order. So the gap that you saw was on a second separate exam. So it's harder to know, you know, not taking the same exam twice. We'd expect them to retain the material and therefore continue to perform better. The difference, though, was about 5%, and that's not a statistically significant movement. It looks interesting, though. So yeah, we will be testing that. On the first question, the amplified assistance is focused on student behavior. You watch what the students are doing or not doing in the LMS. You can watch their quiz attempts. You can see where they're working on quiz outcomes. And you can, from the quiz attempts, give them information about the concepts that they're having trouble with, not the questions, right? You give information about the concepts, but we also personalize the messages. So on the UPACE website, we have a set of templates that an instructor can use. So you pull the template off, and then you personalize the template, and you make it individual for that student. What we find is that students, particularly students who are perhaps underprepared or haven't had a very successful experience in a learning environment, will, in this idea of perceived control, will test the environment at first. That's why you need to get to them right away. So if you watch their behavior, you can see them starting to withdraw, sometimes as early as 3 or 4 days. You get in there, you can do 2 things for them. One is you give them the information that they need, the concepts they're having trouble with, and where to find that. Right? The second, and maybe more important, is to say, I notice that you're having some difficulty, and I'm watching that. But it's natural to have difficulty at this point in time. And what we find are that students who keep at it and work through this difficulty will excel in the course. Right? So you can sort of hit both what they need to learn better and work on the psychology part of why they're having the difficulty in the first place.
I have a question that maybe you could both address. That's prompted by the sense of, or the process of measuring the sense of control. But the larger question is, how do you take things from the literature and measure them in a kind of very practical way? Are you adopting instruments that were developed and are established elsewhere? Could you give us all some advice about that?
Maybe we can both address that. And I think it's been a little bit of both. To some degree in our work, we've taken instruments that have been developed by others, which is always a good idea. I mean, if someone has worked on an instrument, on some measure of something, and you can adapt it to your own purposes, terrific. We have tended, and this was part of my point in saying that you should try to develop a long-term project of many individual studies, is that you can then refine that instrument for your own purposes, right? So your factor analysis may yield a slightly different set of factor loadings than the folks at Milwaukee got, or the folks at Florida got, or the folks at Berkeley got, something like that. So you can refine it on your own with your own population.
And another way of approaching that is you have to ask yourself, what do I need to know from the student? What do I need to know about the student to help, right? So the sense of control here was a sense of control over learning in the course. So it has to be specific. So, you know, there are very generalized internal locus of control, external locus of control scales that probably won't do you any good. Then what you have to do is measure that across the semester, across the time period of the course. So the scores that I showed you, the change scores, were from the beginning when they had really very little, if any, experience with the course to the end. You really can't document a putative mediator other than to show that it develops across time.
Can you tell us what exactly you used to measure that sense of control on the students? Was it survey-based, or how exactly did you do that?
It was just a series of 7-point questions. It wasn't a scale. I don't know if there's a scale out there about sense of control over learning in a course, but in this case, we felt it important to focus it very carefully on what they were experiencing in the course, not outside.
We have one question over here.
Just kind of a methodological question, and maybe I missed this, but how were the students selected for the UPACE program? Was it self-selection, or was it a random assignment? And if it wasn't self-selection, even if it was, what kind of attention was there to sort of patterns and predispositions of the students? For example, maybe the UPACE students were just the superstars or something like that.
First of all, at the beginning when we did this, it was self-selection, but the first course that Diane ran, students came to a classroom, had no idea, other than it was Psych 101, they didn't know what they were getting into. But since then, we have a randomized controlled trial, so we have random assignment to conditions, and we have a stratified trial, so we're breaking out students who we call non-disadvantaged, right, versus disadvantaged, versus those who are underachievers on the learning and combinations of those. So the stratification process, you randomly assign to the different elements, and we also make sure, to the best you can, you make sure that you have roughly the same proportions of individuals in the study.
One more?
Yes. I have a question about the 24 quizzes that you mentioned in the UPACE program. If I understood you correctly, you mentioned that they were within an LMS, so that means that they were taken online.
I couldn't hear all that. There was noise.
The 24 quizzes
that are part
of the UPACE program, were they delivered online?
Yes, they were.
Okay, and then a question then. How did you control for the somewhat ubiquitous tendency of students to cheat online?
When the questions were first developed, and this is no easy feat, right, to develop these kinds of questions, because we're trying to push them from the base levels up to more complex reasoning, right, to the best you can with multiple choice questions. Yeah. When these were first developed, Diane ran these through a class, and she saw how much time it took students to answer them.
Okay.
So what you can read in the literature is you should give about a half a minute per question,
right,
on exams. The data that Diane collected showed that we needed to give them 6 minutes. Right? In the process, what happens, they can, as in with any mastery-based program, they can take quizzes multiple times,
right,
but they're being fed from a large bank of questions. So if you have two quiz banks per chapter, each quiz bank would have 80 to 100 questions.
Okay.
And then the computer will select. The second
right.
part of that
right.
is we don't tell the students which question they got wrong,
okay,
but we do feedback to the students which concepts they need to focus on.
Okay.
Is it possible that someone could cheat? Sure. But
right,
it's
right.
it's unlikely given the time constraints.
Yes.
And that's another measurement issue, right?
Yes.
We didn't just give a half a minute. We measured what it took with these particular
sure.
questions in a classroom and therefore gave 6 minutes instead of five.
Fantastic.
I hope that helps.
Can I slip in one more question? This is a question for Walker. Walker, you're like this. This is a philosophical question. namely, you know, what do we really mean when we say X? So I was really struck by your very first slide, which showed a great strength and gain in, I think, grades in the courses that were taught in those rooms. So one would be tempted to say, oh, in these types of classrooms, students learn better. But the question is, what do we really, is that kind of a superficial take on things? What does it really mean? What is that diagram really saying? Is it saying something, what Vincent Tinta was saying, is that we need a lot of focus, a lot of people all contributing to that experience? Or is it just the classroom that's making the difference and enabling that increase in learning?
That's an excellent question. And when we first conducted our research on the active learning classrooms, and we found an improvement in student learning when compared to the same course offered in a traditional room, and we presented these findings to folks, one reaction that we got from a certain subset of the audience was to say, oh, so these are magic classrooms. So I can just walk in and teach my class in the same way I've taught it for the last 35 years, and suddenly my students will learn more. How do you like that? Right? And I think that's the wrong conclusion, I think. And I'm going to come back here again to the point that both Ray and I have been emphasizing, which is that in research of this sort, you need to understand the mechanisms, the moderators and mediators whereby an effect is resulting from the intervention in the first place. So there are different things happening in these classrooms. So as I mentioned before, I think there are changed relationships in the classrooms. There's changed behavior on the part of instructors. There are a variety of that influence the improvements that we're seeing. So there are several things going on, and you know, watch this space, and we'll have more to say about that. I think we are now running out of time. Should we? Yeah. Okay, we have another one. Sure.
Yeah, it should be pretty short. You mentioned that there are now six disciplines using the UPACE model.
Yes.
I tried some quick Googling and couldn't find out what they are, so can you point me towards a URL or just tell me?
I don't know if you find it on a URL. Started in psychology, we're in sociology, they're preparing political science, environmental science. There's an English course on what's called American Indian Literature, and I'm blanking on the sixth. There was some foray in math, in developmental math, too.
Okay. Cool. Thank you.
All right. Well, I think we'll just thank you very much for your questions and for your attention.
Ray Walker, thank you very much.
Thank you.